Okay, so I just wanted to finish this discussion up on renormalization and how it affects things in terms of running and then the counterterms that we're introducing. And then we'll get to the Higgs mechanism, okay? So just to remind you, we were talking about QED and its running. In the QED running, we introduced a bunch of renormalization constants. Most of you saw this last time, just to remind your brains. So we renormalize the field in this way. We introduce these renormalized fields compared to the bare fields with these Zs. We renormalize the fermion field with introducing this Z. And then we renormalized the charge, which introduced a mu and a Z at the same time. And then we renormalized the mass by introducing this other renormalization factor for the mass in QED. Okay? So some of the technical things which I was going over quickly, just to be a little more clear on, is whenever you do this sort of renormalization, you're choosing these Zs to basically cancel off some divergences in the loop diagrams. Remember, the diagrams that we looked at were diagrams like this, and that gave us ZA. And then we looked at this diagram, and that gave us Z psi and ZM. And then we can also look at this diagram, if you want to calculate it directly, which we can use to define ZE, or we can actually use the relationship between these two, which comes about because of the unbroken symmetries in the theory. But you can just directly calculate it. So when I was talking about my Zs and defining them, I said something about how we're using MS bar in renormalization, minimal subtraction scheme. And I was going to just define that a little more carefully. So we have the ability to choose these Zs. So the choice that we're making is we're choosing to just subtract the divergent bit. When we're using dimensional regularization, 4 minus 2 epsilons. And then epsilon is small. We have to identify this number by calculating these diagrams and calculating and then subtracting by choice. But we're just subtracting this bit. Okay, you can choose different things. You could subtract other things. Other schemes exist. You can choose the scheme you wish. But you have to be consistent in the choice you make to have predictive power because you use this choice once. And then you use the results from calculating a perturbation theory consistently for many, many observables. Okay? And then when you relate observables to other observables in a scheme that you choose, then the scheme dependence cancels out. If you calculate one observable, the choice that you make will actually affect the numerical value you get. But two observables with the same scheme choice, that scheme dependence will cancel out. And that's what we really test experimentally, some observable related to another observable in perturbation theory. Okay? So the minimal subtraction is just subtracting the epsilon. It's just subtracting the divergent bit in 4 minus 2 epsilons. MS is for minimal subtraction. If you see it as MS bar, the bar is that we just do one other thing to clean things up. We take the mu that we introduced here, and we shift it so that we get rid of this Euler gamma that appears in loop diagrams when you actually do the momentum integrals and the 4 pi's. If you do this shift, you just are rescaling mu slightly, which is you're just introducing as this resolution scale that you were putting in by hand. And this, these factors, when you expand out in the loop diagrams, will cancel off explicit appearances of Euler gammas and 4 pi's and logs that appear otherwise. It's just ugly, those things, and so we just make that choice to cancel those off as well. So if you do these sorts of calculations, the clean way to do it is to use dimensional regularization and MS bar subtraction, and then you basically are identifying these numbers within the context of doing this shift and using this sort of 4 minus 2 epsilon regularization of your momentum integrals. So that's what we were doing last time, and that just cleans up your answer. Okay, so I wanted to finish this discussion a little bit by being a little bit more exact. Is it this? Okay, so we looked at diagrams which were allowing us to infer these particular values for the normalization constants. Okay, under the MS bar subtraction, we calculate this one, we calculate this one, and this one. And then we can also calculate directly ZE, or we can just use the relationship that's actually present between these two things given here to infer ZE from ZA. So this relationship might not be obvious to you, You can formally derive that as a consequence of the unbroken U1 symmetry in the theory, that you do get this sort of relationship between these renormalization constants. It's something called a Ward identity. We'll talk about that in a little more detail later. But this is a sign of the unbroken symmetry appearing in the loop diagrams. Okay? Or you can just calculate it directly if you don't believe me, right? You should always check it directly. It's a one loop calculation. And you'll see that it exactly holds this relationship at one loop. Calculate this one and this one. So sometimes you usually see loop expansions, loop diagrams. We say that they're expanded actually not in the G's that we've been using, but in alphas. So it's like alpha over 4 pi is the perturbative expansion for an observable, where alpha here is actually G squared over 4 pi. These are something called the fine structure constant for QED. This is the 1 over 137 famous number, which until you know it experimentally, it could have been any other value and that would have led to different phenomenology. Okay, so but it is a very small perturbative number. So we calculate observables, like all sorts of things in terms of scattering of electrons and photons, and we get a number, and then we get this 1 over 4 pi expansion. And this thing depends upon mu, okay? So is this all clear? Just wanted to flesh this out a little more clearly in terms of QED, how it all fits together. Any questions? This is the calculational framework. Okay, good. If there are any questions, let me know. Okay, so that's basically,
Is 137 like scheme dependent or not?
Alpha, it's at scale dependent.
Scale, yes.
So it's like at MZ goes to like 1 over 137. So there's a lot, so essentially there is a scheme dependence in the sense of you need to choose a calculational scheme or a normalization scheme, a subtraction scheme to then calculate observables where you then extract alpha. So there's a residual small scheme dependence that's around. So usually this is an MS bar value of alpha evaluated at MZ. This is actually a very interesting little beast in terms of precision phenomenology. It's a very small number, but just as a sidebar, I'll take a moment as a sidebar because it's kind of interesting. So what we actually do in terms of very precision calculations that we engage in to test the standard model is we actually measure alpha not at MZ, but we measure it at very low scales. So there's like atomic trap experiments where they have an ion, and they look at like one photon emissions from that atomic trap. So essentially, they're measuring the Coulomb field. So they're doing like H bar one emission photons, essentially at P squared goes to zero. And then from that, they infer alpha actually at around the scale zero. Like a bit, essentially it's cold. It's as cold as can be, so the scale is incredibly small. And this is then run up to give you an alpha of MZ. So to give you an idea of these sorts of numbers, it changes from like 1 over 128 to 1 over 137 in that running. But most of the change is actually something that's a bit subtle. Coming from here to here, you have to run through pions, and because the pion mass is above zero, but it's below MZ. So there's some non-perturbative stuff that happens with QCD and its bound states that you have to run through, and that correction is what is most of the numerical difference of starting at the low scale and getting to the big scale. So as we said the other day in terms of masses and the VEV, it's always that we're measuring a whole bunch of things at different scales and combining them into a precision test of the standard model. And this is actually measured at an incredibly low scale, even below the muon scale that was setting V. And it's only by including these running effects that we actually consistently test the experimental results and find that it actually does work. Okay, so we already are sensitive to like multiple loops in the electroweak theory. Okay. So a little more detail on the running, just to finish up the point we were getting to yesterday. Okay, so the running, we now know ZE, so we introduce this mu. Okay, so if we want to figure out essentially how the running couplings work, then what we do is we actually take the derivative with respect to mu, or we take the logarithmic derivative in this way to see how things change with respect to mu. Now this doesn't have any mu dependence, it's the bare coupling. So We know that derivative. It's an easy answer. It's 0. But we also know this is related in this exact way in terms of how we've renormalized the theory and introduced this resolution scale mu, right? So mu dd mu of z of this bare coupling is exactly equal to this combination. And this is 0, right? So we just use the chain rule on this expression here, explicitly expand it out and pull out this common factor. In the scheme that we've chosen and dim reg and MS bar subtraction. So when we expand this out, this term, we take a derivative, gives us an epsilon. We have dd mu on E, and that actually defines this thing called the beta function. We pulled out an overall E, so that's 1 over E. And then we have mu, and then we pull out a ZE, and we have dd mu on this ZE that we've now calculated at one loop, right? But we know this expression. It's 0. And if we want to figure out how the couplings run, which is what this beta function does, we can just use this expression iteratively in perturbation theory to actually define it and then get the logarithmic running. So what you do is the following. Let me know if I'm going too quick because I wrote this stuff down before. I just wanted this to be very clear because it's a bit technical. So what we do, we want to find the running coupling. So the running coupling by definition was mu dd mu. Oh, well, of the electron. Didn't write down. So this expression is in here, right? So we also can just rewrite this expression and we know the dd mu of the beta function. We can just express in terms of the other two terms. That's just this term and this term. We calculated this exactly at one loop. We can calculate it at two loops or three loops or five loops if we're very strong. But we know it, so we just plug it in. And when we plug in the expression for this, we actually expand out, and then we get that this leading perturbative correction, which is still present as epsilon goes to 0, is this term, which came directly from the renormalization of the charge. Okay? So all we're doing is we're just using the fact that this combination is 0, this is one loop, this is something that's tree level, and so we're just iteratively re-expressing, putting in this expression to the in this place to then get this term. Okay, so then we take epsilon goes to 0, and then we have a simple differential equation of this form. That the running coupling that we derived in that one loop diagram with this subtraction scheme that we chose is related to exactly this 1 over 12. It's a famous result in QED. Okay? So then if you solve this differential equation, you will find that solving this differential equation, this is a logarithmic running of mu, means that 1 over e squared at a scale mu 2 is related to 1 over e squared at a scale mu 1, and then the 1 12th, and then the logarithmic dependence. This is just the solution of this simple differential equation. Okay, so that's how it fits together. That's how we actually get these sorts of things in these running couplings. Okay? So is this all clear? Like this QED case should be very clear in your head before we start to talk about the more complicated cases that we can also do, like QCD and that sort of thing. So hopefully, is this very clear? Okay. Logarithmic running basically is what happens in terms of these different groups at one loop. And what you should expect that because essentially you're going to get a polynomial dependence in the coupling over 16 pi squared. So it's going to be a simple differential equation of like this form. It's going to have the same powers. So it's basically always going to be logarithmic because that's going to solve the differential equation. The only question is what is the numerical value and what is the sign that you get when you do these subtractions? Those things can change between different groups, but the simple form of the differential equation dictates logarithmic dependence, and that is basically universal. Okay? So, and it's also linked, you notice, directly with the divergences, which were what were being plugged in here, defining ZE, okay? So the log running behavior is very directly related to the divergent structure of the theory, the UV divergent structure of the theory. Okay. Everyone seems to be happy with this. Okay, good. All right, so what can happen in terms of energy scale? It's going to be universally logs. It's a matter of what the sign is and the numerical value is. So what can happen, it's pretty straightforward, as you go as a function of energy for couplings, It either goes up or it goes down. That's all we got, right? So it either does this, which is the case of SU2, the running G2, or the U1, the hypercharge running, or it goes down. And that's the case of SU3 or G3, okay? So people have asked the question in field theory of whether they can have different behavior, and essentially the answer is no. I mean, essentially this is the sort of simple behaviors you get when you have, you know, normal sort of abelian groups and interacting quantum field theories. Now you'll notice that this blows up at low scales. This is an energy, this is the scale of which we're doing experimental result, this mu that we're choosing. So we choose mu. We choose mu to be roughly equal to the experimental scale because when we had our observable, the expression for the observables, there'll be a number. There'll be a number, and then it's alpha dependent mu over 4 pi, and another number, so on and so forth in the perturbative expansion. And in here, there's logs. And you want these logs to be as small as possible. And you have the ability to choose your mu related to the experimental result. So you choose mu essentially related to roughly what are the sort of scales defining the experimental measurement to minimize the size of the corrections and perturbation theory. Nevertheless, so you're choosing that. So nevertheless, you'll notice that in case of SU3, it blows up. There's a scale at which things, as you go smaller and smaller in mass scale, things are getting out of control. This is what's called lambda QCD. Okay? And it's about 100 MeV. So it's a scale which is generated in the theory spontaneously because of perturbation theory. This is what we mean by when we say QCD is a strongly interacting gauge theory. And at low scales, it confines. And then you have to go to another phase. And you think about things like protons and neutrons and pions, as opposed to the up quarks and down quarks that build those combined structures up. Okay, this scale, let's just take a moment and think about the scales and the masses, right? This scale is kind of important. So it just appeared in the theory. We didn't cheat. We didn't really cheat in the other case. But remember, we did this by hand, right? We put that in by hand, that scale, and now another scale is present in the theory. It's being spontaneously generated in perturbation theory. This one we actually infer from experiment in a way that we'll talk about in detail from muon decay. But it's a number that we're putting in by hand when we construct the potential, because we're expanding around that symmetry breaking minimum. But this one's been generated. So it's actually quite a useful thing to think about the various scales and essentially expand in ratios of scales, as I've been trying to emphasize over and over and over again. Okay? So what mass scales do we have? Let's just remind ourselves. So now we have some quark masses, like ups and downs. And they're much, much, much smaller than the mass of the top, the mass of the W experimentally, the mass of the Z experimentally, the mass of the Higgs. And now we have lambda QCD. And lambda QCD is actually bigger than these as well. Right? So now we have is bigger than the mass of the up and the mass of the down. This, though, is about the same size as the mass of the charm quark and the mass of the S quark. And it's also true that lambda QCD is much, much less than the mass of the bottom quark and the mass of the top quark. Okay. So we're always doing, if we want to interface with experiment, smart limits if we want to do the calculations precisely and efficiently. So there's actually a whole series of effective theories of the standard model you can construct taking ratios of these scales. So if you look at this, you should probably think, well, if that's true, that m up and m down is much, much less than 1, then maybe I should do an expansion in small up quark masses and small down quark masses. If you do that, what do you do? So if you do this goes to zero, then remember we had psi bar left, you know, the propagators. And the only terms that was putting together the left and the right-handed components was the mass terms that we're now going to take an expansion and neglect. So these terms, so for example, the up quark mass plus the Hermitian conjugate, will now be taking a limit in that expansion, which is experimentally motivated, that this goes to zero. So if this goes to zero, then we have independently these two propagators around, and we can change these by individual rotations. So we can individually rotate these with a U3 rotation, and this with a U3 rotation, or an SU3 rotation. So there's a big symmetry group, SU3 cross SU3, that then is being pulled out of the overall standard model in the limit that the masses are small. Okay, so that's an effective theory again. That's what's called, and we're going to talk about that in more detail, chiral perturbation theory. And it's a low energy, small mass limit of QCD. So it's an effective theory of QCD. And because you have these symmetry groups around, it gives you predictive power in terms of examining a lot of low energy data in terms of QCD results. Okay, so this is an example of an EFT of the standard model and exactly of QCD. And that's, I mean, the facts of what the size of things are is really quite determinative in terms of how we do experimental results, right? So nobody takes QCD and takes the full QCD Lagrangian written in terms of quarks and does painful calculations where you do and keep all the quark masses around to then interface with the properties of pions and baryons. I mean, you can do it, but you're just wasting your time. You're doing a whole bunch of calculations. Then, you know, you basically do not make calculational progress in terms of interfacing with experimental results, because you're not using the symmetries which are built in, and you're not making your life easy. So everyone does chiral perturbation theory in studying these low energy states. Okay, so it really matters what the exact masses are. So there's another thing that comes out of this, which you probably noticed, lambda over MB is also much less than 1. Okay, so this was 100 MeV, and this, remember, was like 4 GeV. Okay, so you can also do that expansion in QCD. When you do that, essentially you have B quarks in bound states, and they're just jiggling around a little bit, but they're jiggling around by lambda QCD sort of effects. And then the mass of the B quark is so big, the B quark in like B mesons, bound states involving Bs, it's basically stable, and it just jiggles a little bit. That you get by doing this expansion, and that allows you to study the decays of B mesons and the oscillation properties of B mesons, which is how we learn a lot of precision phenomenology about CP violation in the standard model. Okay, so we have a huge experimental program for 30 years. It's on heavy quarks. People do their whole careers on this. And this is HQET, which is heavy quark effective theory, which is this sort of thing. Okay, so this is another limit of the standard model, which is another effective field theory showing up. So at this stage, it probably should be obvious to you that it's just, standard model is just a ton of effective field theories in terms of how we actually interface with experimental results. Okay. That's just built in to the numerical values that are present. So I wanted to do a little bit of a couple more words in terms of what happens when you have massive vectors. Okay, so this is the nice story when you have a massless vector in QED. We saw how you do renormalization, you get the running coupling. So how do we actually start to think about having the other sort of symmetry groups, the other sorts of effects when you have a massive vector? So let's say the mass is greater than zero. So I'm not going to do this calculation in detail, but I'm just going to say a couple words about it so you can just check how it works so you understand conceptually how these things fit together. Okay? So if we did this diagram, we did it before, what happens when we have MA being greater than 0? Well, now we've changed the propagator, right? So now it's the propagator is minus I, P squared minus MA squared. This wasn't there before. G mu nu, and then minus K mu, K, or P nu. P nu over MA squared. This is actually a gauge-dependent piece. We'll talk about gauge fixing in more detail. But there's just extra terms like this involving the mass of the vector field you could introduce. So what would happen if we actually plug that in here? Well, you can just check yourself, right, with those three formulas I told you about how to do loop diagrams. What you get so this will be Q, this will be P, is you just get some extra terms, right? And then we have 1 over Q squared minus MA squared now. That MA squared wasn't there before in the other calculation that we did. And this had a G mu nu, and this had another, and there's some I's I'm suppressing here. There's I minus I canceling, actually. So there's this term. And then we also have, in this case, Q, Q nu over MA squared. Okay? So all that's going to happen is that we do this diagram that we did before, and we have an extra MA squared in the piece that we did before downstairs. So when we combine denominators, that's an extra scale downstairs. But you still go through the same three steps, right? You combine denominators, you shift the momenta to get rid of the linear pieces of momenta, and use that one loop formula that I wrote for you the other day. And that term you can just directly evaluate. And then this term, you'll notice what happens here. These Qs are going to contract with these gammas, right? And then you're going to get things like this, Q squared, P slash plus Q squared, Q squared, Q squared. And that's three gammas. Remember we had that formula of how we had gamma, 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 and it went to G gamma, you know, minus a G gamma plus a G gamma. And then there was another term minus epsilon, the gamma 5. Remember that formula? I'm suppressing the indices. That lets you reduce three gammas down to just G's and one gamma. So if you do that here, what will happen is you'll get extra factors of Q squared in the numerator compared to what we had before because of this extra term. So when we're doing the integrals, we get this sort of thing now, and we have to shift denominators. Okay, with this extra term in the numerator. The extra term in the numerator, all it does at the end of the day when you use the formula, plug it in explicitly that I wrote for you, is it pulls up some of these mass factors into the numerator. Okay, so what you will find at the end of the day, and I'm just sketching this out for you so you know what happens, is you'll find you'll get divergences. It'll be a number over 16 pi squared epsilon. And then with these masses coming in the numerator, you'll get things like this. Okay? And then things like P slash will also be there. Just like in the case of the wave function normalization that we had in the other case we talked about. So these extra factors, you have to figure out where they come from and how to cancel them off. There'll be extra divergences. So you have divergences like this when you do this sort of diagram. You plug in all of the z's, and you won't cancel off all of the divergences. There'll be an extra divergence left over. So what you need to do is you basically need to introduce something which gives a Feynman rule which looks like this bit and cancels off the divergence. Okay, so in this case, what you actually will find if you do this exercise, it's actually going to be this one as a counter term, as an operator that you have to introduce. You'll have to introduce it like this. This is just a d squared and a d slash, okay? And what you do is you start off with this being a bare field and a bare field, just like we did in QED. You introduce the two renormalization constants for the fermion fields. So you renormalize this one, renormalize this one, and that will lead to z psi squared here, or I think I did it with, no, it's just going to be linear power, the way I did it in convention. So you renormalize these two things, and this will give you some divergences, but you still won't subtract all the divergences when you plug this in to cancel off this thing. So you'll have to introduce another z, which is z for this operator, this particular form here, this operator. So you have to introduce another counter term, another divergence subtraction by hand, just to cancel this thing off. But you can always do this. And that's actually how it works. So that's why you can always calculate with these massive vectors as well. Okay? So I'm not going to go into the details of that, but I just want to make that clear. All right. So are you convinced that we can calculate with massive vectors at this stage? Tree level, one loop, and it all fits together consistently.
It's still not clear to me how the lambda QCD gets generated, because I still have to like put in some RG scale by hand, I guess, right? Like
you need to measure some couplings.
Conditions. Like, well, the lambda QCD, how is it like different to other parameters? I get that it's like a loop effect, like
yeah.
Coupling is marginal at tree level, but I still have to like put in initial conditions, right, for the RG. So how is it like?
Yeah, you need to measure boundary conditions. That's right.
Yeah. So,
so you need to fix the you need to fix a boundary condition for some scale. That's correct.
So it's still put in by hand, by experiment?
In a very weak logarithmic dependent sense. Yeah, so you still need to fix something from experiment. So what you're saying, which is correct, is that so at some point we had to fix something on this curve so you knew where that curve sat. The overall behavior of it going up like this happens because of just the quantum effects in the theory, but normalizing it up and down, you're correct that you need to measure at some scale and fix where it is. So the shape is something that's just quantum mechanical and just due to the loops. But then normalizing and fixing that, well, at this scale, it was this exact numerical value. That's what you're talking about. And you're right that you need to fix that. But we say it's spontaneously generated in the theory itself, independent of that, because whatever value you found here, this shape came out of the quantum corrections. And that was not something that, you know, we put in by hand. Okay? Yeah. So we did choose our subtraction scheme, which did choose a scheme dependence which fixed this a little bit. Okay? But that doesn't change because you get the basic differential equations of that form, no matter what scheme you use. That doesn't change that it's a logarithmic dependence, which means this shape is there and it's actually predictive in the field theory. And the sign is something that you can't change by renormalization scheme choices, the way you choose subtract divergences. You can't change the sign that's there for the coupling. Okay? So if it goes this way or that way, is something that's just purely generated in the quantum field theory, independent of us. Yeah?
And for the Higgs, we sort of put it in by hand, and that's why we say that this is like better than the Higgs.
The V. Well, I'll show you how we actually extract that experimentally. As it is, we just put in this symbol, you know, by hand as a bare scale that's present in the Lagrangian. Remember when we wrote this down? So we wrote this down by hand, okay? But we didn't give it a numerical value until we experimentally measure it.
And the difference is that we, like, put in the shape of the potential by hand?
Yeah. This is basically because we're expanding around. So essentially our fields, they're defined on a field space and there's a potential space. And this is actually leading to, which we're going to talk about in detail. We're getting there. We're almost there. where it's leading to the Mexican hat potential that's usually called, right? So it's just, as I try to emphasize, just a characteristic feature of when you're expanding around a symmetry breaking minimum. It's all over in physics, but this is something you put by hand. And this V you put by hand, we don't know it numerically yet, but this we put in by hand, whereas we didn't put in by hand this. Okay?
So that hat bitmap doesn't depend when you start?
It depends slightly. That's why it's a squiggle. So, you know, so some people say it's 100 MeV, some people say it's 200 or 600. So there's a fuzziness there. Because on the scale of like 100 of MeV, and no matter what, you know, fuzziness you're moving it around, it's still much bigger than the up and the down quark. Remember they were like 2 and 5 MeV.
Yeah.
So it's a good symmetry limit no matter what. There's some scheme dependence that happens, but it does work. Okay? All right. So summary statements. We can always calculate, even with these massive vectors, the kind of quick statements of like renormalization and the gauge symmetry means you can't write down massive vectors. There's subtleties involving, you know, essentially how those masses are introduced and if they come from scalars and what sort of energy scales you're actually measuring experimentally. So those subtleties are all around. And we can calculate always in an effective theory, even with massive vectors, we just have to introduce extra counter terms. And we have to do a tower of higher dimensional operators that actually deal with the divergences that are around. So we have to go to an effective theory of the standard model when we have the massive vectors by hand. Okay. So what exactly, in the case of the standard model, is the effective theory of the standard model with these masses, like the Stackelberg case? Let me write that down for you, and you can see how it's now, from what we said earlier, is now building up to the standard model case. And you see how the Higgs does one other thing, which is really special and really kind of amazing, which makes it such a good way to generate masses of fermions and vectors. So we're going to write down something that's called, and it's another effective theory of the standard model. It's called the electroweak chiral Lagrangian. And all it is the effective theory that has explicit masses for the W and Z put in by hand. Okay. So what is it? It has a lot of its structure, which is just exactly the standard model. Remember, these are the SU2 gauge fields. This is the hypercharge gauge field. And this had to do with QCD, which we've been talking about a bit. We have fermions. We sum over all the fermions. And these are the chiral left and right fermions, just like in the standard model. And now we do the magic. It's not really magic, like the Stackelberg mechanism, but in the case of the standard model, we write down this. And we wait for lightning to strike and people to get upset. This is a sigma field. What is sigma? Sigma is a field we introduce. And remember, when we do these masses, we have these nonlinear representations of symmetry. So it's an exponential, actually. So it's very nonlinear. And it has sigma A, so it has the Pauli matrices. And it has some fields we introduce, pi A, which are the Goldstone bosons giving mass to the W and the Z. They're of dimension 1, so we put a V scale, because it's the only scale in the problem. We have an I here. So this is an exponential field, okay? So we've done something which might make you think, what the heck is happening? But remember, when we do masses, we had to take expansions of things, which were linear representations. We took the propagators, we expanded out. So it was kind of intrinsic when we put masses down that we shared a symmetry amongst series of terms. And this is a particular sum of a series of terms, which has the right symmetry properties for writing the mass down that we want. We can do this. And then when we do perturbation theory, we expand out in terms of, you know, orders in pi, this Goldstone, we're allowed to do this sort of thing. And this is actually always what you do when you write down a nonlinear representation of a symmetry. Chiral perturbation theory, which I mentioned, is formulated exactly like this. It was formulated in the 60s like this, with an exponential field. So you write down with the Goldstones. We'll talk about that in more detail. So this is not, this might seem very weird to you at the start, but it's actually quite characteristic whenever you have a nonlinear representation of a symmetry. And in effective theories, we do this all the time. Okay? This will give mass to the W and Z. And then we actually have to write down the fermion masses. So we do this. U left I bar, B left I bar. We need the sigma again. And we write down our Yukawa matrices. Plus the Hermitian conjugate. And whenever you do this sort of thing, you know you have higher dimensional operators. You always have to have that at tree level and at one loop to cancel the divergences. This is a theory we can write down. This is a theory people wrote down over the years many, many times. This sigma field has a nice transformation property. It actually transforms on the left and the right by these left-right transformations, the chiral right and left transformations, to cancel off the transformation of this left and this right. This is why it's called an electroweak chiral Lagrangian, because it has this chiral left-right transformation property of the sigma field. Okay. Now, if you expand this theory out, if you take this term and you expand it out, what you will find is you have massive W's and Z's. This term will explicitly give you, but it's going to be the W longitudinal components. So it'll actually give you two terms in terms of the pi's, which you identify as the longitudinal extrapolarization state of the W field. And it'll also be okay, so we basically took these guys and we wrote down explicitly masses by hand. Okay? So you should be shocked and horrified, or maybe not. Maybe now, because of the other things we've talked about, this doesn't surprise you at all that we can do this. Hopefully you're at that state. And this, similarly, for the fermions, when you expand this guy out, you get a V and it's small coupling. So this is basically writing down the mass by hand. This is in the case of the standard model. So when you, until you find MH, which is 125 GV, so you do experiments below this scale, you have masses for the Zs, you have masses for the fermions, this is what you write down, and this is how we can interface with experimental results. And that's what we were doing until 2012, effectively. Or we were assuming the standard model and calculating in that for reasons which we'll hopefully get to. Okay, so here's another really cool thing that the Higgs does. Okay, I want to keep this. I will keep this. Let me erase this. Okay. So, as always, let's calculate and see what actually happens when we actually calculate, not just, you know, speculate, but calculate. That's kind of the EFT effective field theory mantra. Less speculation, more calculation. So, what can we calculate? What will be interesting to calculate? What will be interesting to calculate, because we did this weird thing, introducing this field, these longitudinal components of the vectors, would be scattering of those states. All right? So we could think about calculating this. Or equivalently, these pi fields that we've introduced as external states. And it's not just this diagram, it's also this diagram. You have to take the diagram where you cross the legs, and you also have to add this diagram, always with these W's. But you can write down the full set of these diagrams and do this scattering. You can actually figure out the scattering amplitude. Okay? So if you do the scattering amplitude for W long from adding up these diagrams, just writing down a perturbation theory. So you take this theory, your Fourier transform it, get its Feynman rules, plug those Feynman rules in, calculate these diagrams. What do you get? What you get is something very interesting. Something that goes as G squared, the couplings here, the mass of the W that you've explicitly introduced by hand appears in the propagator, so it appears in the scale downstairs at the end of the day, just like in the case of the massive vector that we were talking about a second ago. But this isn't divergent. This is a tree-level result. And it goes as S plus T. So S, these are the Mandelstam variables. So they're P1 plus P2 all squared. T equals P1 minus P3 by convention I'm using here, all squared. And U equals P1 minus P4 all squared, where P1, P2, P3, P4 are these momenta of the initial states. So it goes as S plus T, some particular combination of external momenta. You can not just stop there. You can actually do this diagram as well. Right? We also introduced massive fermions. So this we can do. It could go through a Z or a photon. And we can do this scattering diagram at tree level. And the theory is defined, so we can just do the Fourier transform, generate the Feynman rules, calculate this directly. This one's quite straightforward. And what do you get here? You get an amplitude for psi bar psi goes to WL WL, which goes as the mass that we've introduced for the fermions by hand coming from that second term, square root of S over V squared. So it should be obvious to you it depends on the mass in the sense of there's a coupling involving the fermions that give its mass. So this also goes with S. So these amplitudes, what happens? So as S gets big, the amplitude grows. And eventually the cross section, which goes as the amplitude squared integrated over phase space, gets too big. It just keeps growing, gets getting bigger and bigger. And it grows in an unbounded fashion, in principle, if you just did experiments at higher and higher scales. We've now met another thing that's really bad. Why is that bad if we had a cross-section that grew in an unbounded way as a function of energy, and we just measured it at higher and higher energies? What would happen? Any ideas? It's bad. Well, what is a cross-section? It's telling you that you have some initial states and then some final states, and it's telling you the probability of going from those initial states to those final states. Right? That's a scattering amplitude leading to a cross-section. It's defining a probability of transition. It's a transition probability in quantum mechanics. And we're saying the probabilities keep growing. They keep getting bigger and bigger. So eventually the probability is going to be greater than 1. That's bad. Why is that bad? So that's bad because essentially you violated something called unitarity. Okay? Which just means that the probabilities have become greater than 1 in terms of our transition amplitudes. Okay? So why is that bad? Remember, that I'm not going to get through what I wanted to get through today, but that's okay. Remember that in the case of quantum mechanics, we have a Hamiltonian that's defined from a Lagrangian density, which is Hermitian. So by definition, we time evolve our states, we time evolve our system with the Schrodinger equation, right? Did I write all this stuff down? And so ddt of a state with an h bar is the Hamiltonian. Okay, so this time evolution should be unitary. Otherwise, we can't describe our systems at different times in a sensible way. So if we have a transition amplitude go greater than one, this whole thing breaks down. We don't know how to take a theory and basically evolve it in time and talk about the theory at some later time. Okay, so you can just ask yourself the question, what sort of scales does the theory break down? What scales it breaks down is set by V. So it actually breaks down at 4 pi V if you do the analysis. What you have to do is you have to take the scattering amplitude, break it into partial waves, and then look at the partial wave analysis and see when unitarity probably has become greater than 1, and then infer from that the scale at which that happens. The scale we introduced by hand is V, so it's going to be related to V, and it's actually it's simply just like 4 pi V. That's what actually happens. So what this says is that this theory, when you introduce by masses by hand, you can have the mass of the Z and the mass of the W, and you can only use it up to a scale lambda about 4 pi V. Because when unitarity breaks, you could just say stop doing the theory. But the way we interpret it in terms of modern quantum field theory is we just say basically, this is broken, probabilities have become greater than 1 because you did an expansion, which you shouldn't have done. And in this case, it's the expansion that's implicit by introducing these masses by hand. So essentially, we've done an expansion where we've assumed that MH, if the Higgs is giving the mass, is much, much greater than the experimental scales that we're going to probe, right? So if the Higgs is what is in the standard model giving these masses, we've made this assumption and done that expansion when we wrote this thing down with the tower of higher dimensional operators, like we talked about in the simple Stackelberg case and now in the case of the standard model. So if unitarity is violated, that usually means an expansion you made has failed. And this is the expansion that has failed in this case. Okay? So you can't use the theory up here because probabilities are greater than 1. Okay, so now we're going to take one last step, and we're going to finish on time today, towards the Higgs, okay? So what happens if you have a scalar in the spectrum? It doesn't have to be the standard model Higgs yet. What if we put in a scalar? You saw how scalars are intimately involved with giving masses of this form. But you can take this term, and you can say, I'm just going to introduce a scalar. This is an effective theory, so we can go back and we can also write down these dimension 1 H fields over V, multiplying this term, okay? Multiplying this, so this, multiplying this now. And you can also introduce here a correction 1 plus C H over V. This is dimensionless. This is just a coupling C and a coupling A that we don't know at this stage. And we can add this higher dimensional stuff as well. And we can multiply it here. Okay, so we can do this. We can always do this as effective theories by hand. It's suggestive. We know that masses are frequently involved with scalars. So like, let's just put in a scalar with a free coupling and then see what happens. Okay, so doing that, you go back to these calculations. And what's the difference? The difference is, in addition to this, you have another set of diagrams with this coupling, with the H field, with A here and A here. And if you work it out and add this into these, what you get is a correction factor like this. So 1 minus A squared, where A is this free coupling for the scalar to the vectors that are now massive. If you take this term, which has C times H over V, and you add that in to this scattering diagram set, then you have this. This was C, this was A, so it'll probably not surprise you, the correction goes as 1 minus C times A. Okay? So, even if we just have a scalar in the spectrum in addition to massive vectors. Even if we just have a close to one, but not exactly one, then how quickly this grows is still dependent on s plus t. But this is then a small number. So it makes it so that it grows with a small number in front. So it makes the theory be able to predict experiment results with probabilities less than one to higher scales. Right? So whenever we do this, and similarly for this point, what does that do? It basically takes this and it extends the range at which you can use this theory to calculate it. So this is the cutoff scale when you have no scalar. It's 4 pi v. And when you have a scalar, it scales as 4 pi v over square root of 1 minus a squared for the case of just the WW scattering. Okay, so it gets bigger. So you can calculate for larger experimental results, larger range of experimental results you can do in terms of LHC and other sorts of machines. Okay, so what do we know? We know that we found a scalar in the spectrum, which we think is the standard model Higgs, and we know that A is about 1 plus or minus 0.1. It's about 10% close to the standard model case. So just that means that this theory with a scalar, the one we found, and the one that we don't know, we can assume it's a standard model completely, with a standard model Higgs completely, with exactly the couplings in the case of the standard model. But if we say, what do we experimentally know? All we know is this. And then we can say, well, if we know this, should we see other states? Should we be able to use this theory in terms of studying data at LHC? Well, if this is 0.1, you can work out the numbers, and then lambda, in this case, is a few TV, which is basically what we can measure at LHC in terms of scattering events. So it's all consistent that we don't see anything else, that we just see a scalar, and then we can describe all the data so far. And you can obviously see that it's very important to just check the couplings of this scalar more and more precisely to know if we're actually going to the exact standard model case. That's what is a large-scale experimental program involving thousands of people in the world right now. That's why we're doing all that work experimentally and theoretically, trying to figure out if this is happening. There's a very special case you can probably identify. And I'm going to finish right now. So there's a very special case. Can I go down here? Oh, this one. There's a very special case where exactly A is equal to 1 and C is equal to 1 in this normalization I chose. What is happening in that case? In that case, you exactly cancel this high energy growth. And you exactly cancel this high energy growth. Then the cutoff scale goes way above the masses that we see for the W and Z. This you can think of as the defining condition of the standard model Higgs. That's exactly what happens in the case of the standard model. It's the very special case where you exactly cancel that high energy growth, which we would like to establish experimentally as much as possible. And then we have the idea that we can use the theory that we've written down for much higher energy scales and extrapolate over very large regions of energy and do lots of different experimental tests. This is a way of saying this is the defining condition of standard model Higgs. It's that limit of the general scalar case. Okay? I'm going to stop there. I don't want to go over. I've been going over time too much. We'll get on to the exact, we'll develop the standard model Higgs now. Hopefully you're convinced, wow, that's a good theory. That's a good idea. And that we'll do it in detail from the tree level and expand out and do that on Monday. Okay? Yep.
So what happened here is that we like tried to freeze the Higgs, like we were acting as if it's like a background field or something, and
yep,
we got like punished, so we added this potential and
Well, so far all we've done bottom up is we've said we have masses experimentally motivated for W's and Z's and fermions. We just wrote down that theory like in the case of the Stackelberg theory. We know it violates the local symmetries that we want to be present in the theory, like leaping ahead in terms of our understanding of the way the standard model works. But just experimentally driven, we can say we write down these masses, and then we can scatter with them and say, well, can we predict the results of scattering experiments. I mean, the fact that the cutoff scale here, this is actually what happened in the field. Okay, so the fact that the cutoff scale here is 4 pi v, which is like a TV, is exactly the reason that we built a $10 billion machine to look at scattering events up to energies of a TV. Okay, that was the motivation for LHC. This is what was called the no-lose theorem. Because we knew we had massive Ws and Zs. We didn't know. We can guess that we have Snermal Higgs because it's very suggestive, like the way we generate masses. It looks like it's going to be the case. But our opinions are irrelevant. What does experiment say is the real question. And this is 4 pi v, which is like a TV. And so then we, you know, people were convinced, physicists were convinced, okay, let's build a machine that scatters at a TV and see what happens. And what you want to have happen is some nice mechanism to come in to deal with this issue. And that nice mechanism is probably going to involve a scalar with couplings like the Standard Model Higgs. There could be a more extended story, and we just see one degree, one, you know, part of the story, or it could be just the Standard Model. But what we see experimentally is that these couplings are around. There's a scalar around of 125 GeV, close in value. Not exactly. We don't know that experimentally. But now it all fits together consistently. Like the machine we built was did the job. Something had to happen. And what that happened is that we found a scalar in the spectrum, which looks a lot like the Standard Model Higgs. Okay. So bottom up, that's what we know. Now we can say to ourselves, okay, what's a beautiful theory which has a linearly realized gauge symmetry, which involves a scalar, and actually is motivated by this particular case? And that's exactly the Standard Model Lagrangian. It's the special limit of this general scenario, which we could just assume from the get-go. Like, I wrote it down the first day, right? We can just assume it. But if you're a scientist, you should say, well, let's question our assumptions and test them experimentally, right? So this is actually where we sit in terms of our knowledge experimentally. Other questions? Yeah?
So the numbers A and C, do we determine theoretically, or do we need to get those values from experiments?
Okay, I'll tell you a story. So A and C, if you do the Standard Model Lagrangian that I wrote on the first day, and you change to this notation and this normalization, because there was like a normalization with a 2 here, then you'll find that you can derive in the Standard Model case from the Standard Model Lagrangian exactly that C is 1 and A is 1.
Oh, OK.
OK. But what actually happened, which I participated in, which was a lot of fun, was we found a scalar. And some of us, theorists, were telling the experimentalists this story. Don't assume it's the Standard Model Higgs. Test it. And test to see experimentally what happens in terms of these couplings. Okay? So we have all these codes that we use to interface with experimental results, which are based on the Standard Model. But you can go into those codes and you can make the coupling free, which is what we did and convinced them to do. You can calculate all the observables. You can stick that in your data set and take your data from LHC, do a giant global fit, just a chi-squared fit. And you can say within months, and on this day of the Higgs discovery, which is July 4, 2012, they actually did this analysis based on analysis that I and others had done. They can just check and see like what appears, right, in terms of selected from the data, not our opinion. What does the data say? And they made this beautiful plot where you could see that what all the data was combining in on the AC space. This case of the Standard Model is being narrowed in on by all these different experimental measurements. You can find this plot in the literature. I can show it to you if you want. It's kind of a famous thing now. So what they did was they basically let A and C be free. There's a Standard Model point, which is 1-1. And then they did things like all these different production mechanisms of the Standard Model Higgs and decays. And they did the dependence on A and C. And then they all combined up the data, and it's narrowing in on that. That's the experimental fact. So we know theoretically that that's the special point, and we're narrowing in on that point. But as time goes on, that's what we're doing in terms of that research program. Seeing how, like, because at some point it could break, and it doesn't actually converge on the Standard Model case. So we're preserving that possibility while studying the data and saying, what does the data say? Or we could just guess. We could just say it's the Standard Model Higgs. We're smart. We know it's going to be that way. It might be, but it's good to check. Sorry, I'm over time again. Any other questions? Feel free to go. Don't let me hold you over time. Yeah?
Is there a difference between the scale that alpha in QED sets and like lambda QCD? Because I'm thinking that like at tree level, also the QED sort of coupling is marginal. So like, what's the difference between like lambda QCD and like the scale that's set by like alpha or something?
Do you mean, I'm not quite sure I understand your question. Do you mean that they both blow up?
No, like, what I mean is that you say that this lambda QCD is like dynamically generated. Like this alpha is also maybe dynamically generated because E is off.
Well, there's something called a Landau pole, which happens in the case of QED, that blow up at high scales. So we can actually take that curve. So the curves went up, right? Did I still have it, or did I erase it? I erased it. OK, so this was lambda QCD. And then these other ones went up, right? And they actually run so that this scale is really high. I can't remember what exactly it is, but it's like 10 to the 15 GV or something. It's like past gut scales. So it's like something like 10 to, I think it's 10 to the 15. I'd have to check in details. And that's called a Landau pole. Now, another piece of history. It's a lot of history. The idea that there's a Landau pole really confused Landau and the whole Russian school. It's called the Landau pole. He was incredibly influential, incredibly scary Russian physicist. Like, Russian physicists are generally, are there any Russians here? I should be careful. They're generally scary, but he was particularly scary, brilliant man. And he was like sure that if there's a Landau pole in the theory, that formally you can't do perturbation theory, it's ill-defined. And that's true, perturbation theory does break down, but it breaks down at such a high scale, it's kind of like, yeah, but like, you know, chill is the right answer. So the community in the West that developed field theory fell out of favor for many years, most, like many reasons, but in the 60s and 70s, people were not doing field theory. It was in disrepute, partially because Landau poles, things like this. Because you can see, like, I made the point to you that, you know, with any abelian groups that you have, or not abelian groups that you have, you're changing the sign of the running and the number, but this is characteristic. This always happens. And so Landau figured out, well, this happens and this is bad. This theory doesn't work to predict things up here. So it's ill-defined for some observables. True, but the ones that we could, you know, never measure experimentally. So, but that killed field theory in Russia brutally. Like they were too scared of Landau to keep working on it. And well, that's the stories we've been told. In the West, people kind of ignored it, and very few people really persisted with field theory. But one of them was Veltman, who trained Tuft, and then Tuft came along and kind of understood better the renormalizability when you have massive vector fields. This whole story I've been saying about how massive vectors are renormalizable, that was questioned in the theory completely. People were like, this doesn't make any sense. What? How do we deal with masses? Like, there's extra divergences. We don't have predictive power because we have, you know, all these extra divergences we need to do order by order. They didn't understand effective field theory thinking. They didn't understand that, yes, there's these infinite series, but there's a controlled expansion around. So they just gave up on field theory. And so these Landau poles exist, and they are a formal theoretical inconsistency in the theory. And the way we think about them is that, okay, like in the case of QED or QCD, at some high scale somewhere before here, we're going to transition over to some other theory. We'll UV embed the standard model into something else, which will deal with this problem. And we just think of the standard model as an effective theory for these lower energy scales. Just like down here, what we do to actually calculate is we start to think about chiral perturbation theory and bound states of QCD, not the QCD Lagrangian as we wrote it down earlier. So there's formal inconsistencies, but it's like, you know, sometimes formal mathematical things you should not overinterpret.